So, hello and welcome to the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we're going to talk about self-publishing and changes in the publishing industry.
Yeah, so I think particularly about academic self-publishing, are we going to focus on? Or?
Yeah, I think so. To start with, yeah, I think it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, because usually when it comes to academic publishing, articles go in journals, and you know, if you write a book or a monograph, kind of, you want it to be with a really good publisher. We've been talking about for a while, I think, really, haven't we? We've been mulling over the idea of, well, if the ideas in an academic book are the important thing, then it matters more that the ideas get out there rather than it's, you know, the name of the publishing house. So why not just self-publish?
Yeah, and this raises a lot of interesting questions, I think, because on the one hand, as you say, you've got this idea of, well, you want to get the ideas out there, but then at the same time, by doing that, you're opening up the possibility that anyone could put their ideas out there, and there are no then checks and balances to guarantee that the things that you say or the things that I say are coming from an expert, because essentially anyone could do it.
Yeah, so as with both sort of journal articles and books get reviewed by experts in the field, don't they? So an editor of a journal or the publisher of a book will send draft versions to, you know, at least two usually, experts in the field to read it and then kind of have their comments back about should anything be changed, is the conclusions right, is there a adequate kind of depth of understanding and of research overview and stuff like that, isn't there? It's both useful in terms of it can improve the work, because it's having another expert look at it can provide interesting things to add to the work, isn't it? But also it's useful in terms, well, as you kind of mentioned, it provides proof that the piece of writing is of an adequate standard.
Yeah, so it adds an element of academic rigour. I should perhaps add that actually there's also, on the other hand, there's a politics to the whole review process, which is something I'm feeling quite strongly myself at the moment, as I've got two articles that just come back from review. And essentially what happens is you write something in your sort of niche area, and therefore the people you send it to don't necessarily have that expertise. So they'll send it to someone with a vaguely relevant expertise, and they then want to put their own slant on your reading, which completely then undermines your original reading.
Yeah. I think the main, but a significant issue, it seems to be particularly with American academics, where they seem to kind of express this frustration most, is that you submit a piece of writing to a journal, a journal editor or a publisher, and they send out to review, and then one of the reviewers, or maybe two of the reviewers, comes back and says, you should cite this person more, and this person is the reviewer. Because the reviewer wants more references and citations of their work, because it makes them look good.
Yes, and I think I've got personal experience of this. I mean, obviously I don't know, because I don't know who reviewer two happens to be, but there was some very strong language in one review comment that I received that said, this writer basically shows no knowledge of this relevant literature article mentioning a particular author, 2019, and you're thinking, okay, right, so you're mentioning this article that's basically so new that chances are most people haven't seen it. It did seem very sort of carefully chosen comment, that, especially when it was so strongly worded that they clearly don't know anything until they mention this author here, and I'm like, this is suspect. Especially when I then went and looked at the article and found it had added absolutely nothing to what I had to say.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Because I've had articles come back and they said, you could mention this author and this author and this author, and kind of wanted to say, well, actually, all of their work is irrelevant to the point I'm making.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to, yeah, as we were sort of saying, there's a politics to it in terms of, do you kind of come back? And because when you have review comments come to you about a piece of writing you've done, you have a chance to respond to the journal editor, don't you, or the publisher. And you can say, actually, this comment doesn't work, or it's wrong, or whatever. But you kind of have this dilemma: do you just placate the reviewer, kind of then the editor can kind of see that you've taken it all into account, you've done all of these required changes that somebody has pointed out as errors or things that need to be changed. So you've essentially done all those changes, so it should then all be correct. Or do you actually start a debate with the reviewer and say, no, you're wrong on this point, I'm right, this is why.
Yeah.
I think it kind of then puts a bit of a greater responsibility on the editor, doesn't it, in terms of they've got to then decide what they're going to do about it.
Yeah, but then the power's all in their hands in a way, because ultimately as an academic you're under pressure to publish in order to, well, in our case, to get a job in the first place, but in more generally because there are pressures to be published every so often in certain high-standing journals. So almost the emphasis really is on you sort of accepting whatever the reviewers say just because you want them to be on their good books because you want to get published.
Yeah. And I think it's a bit... One reviewer that I had came back and said he didn't like my style of writing. Because I quite like the idea of saying, as we have seen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it's me, the writer, and you, the reader, going on a journey of discovery through this.
Yeah.
Interesting thing that I've kind of found. And one reviewer just said... basically they just didn't like it. Right. So I was like, well, what should I do about this? Because I can just say, well, this is personal choice, so get over it.
Yeah.
Or do I change the duplicate them? And I ended up changing it. Because I thought it was just easier than having a scrap about it, and I just wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah.
But kind of drew attention to the fact that the journal had previously published things that had the same sort of writing style.
Yeah.
So that's kind of another issue, isn't it, about, I suppose it's almost like, what's the word, like veiled criticism, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are power games going on there as well, yeah. Isn't there? There's a bit of an ego going on. I mean, unless the journal has a specific style guide that says it needs to be written in first person or no we's and I's or whatever, I think you're perfectly within your rights to say,
yeah,
it doesn't matter, because there was no initial comment. It's up to the editor, isn't it, really? Yeah,
and I think there's another... I think there's another issue in that a lot, sometimes editors will come to you, will send you an email. Well, often it's an automated email, or it's just they've just put your name and email address into a system that kind of sorts it all out for them. And so it says, will you review it? And that's it. No further guidance. Mm. So, you know, I've done reviews where... the standard for articles for journals where the standard of English was not good enough, and I'm sort of thinking, is it my job to point this out, or is it the copy editor's job to point this out? In the end, I just pointed it out because I was like, someone needs to do it, and I don't know if how good the board of this journal is. Whereas, you know, and then you know, you quite often, if you're a reviewer, you'll see the other reviewers' comments as well. And you find out they've written like 3 paragraphs. So I suppose in addition to different writing styles, there's also different review styles, aren't there?
Yeah. And so in academic journals then, there's a load of politics and a load of power games going on when it comes to publishing. I suppose then when you turn to the book side of things, you've got this issue of, well, there's a sort of a capitalistic imperative. There's a, well, what does the market want? What can we afford to publish? Because books are obviously in print as well. I mean, they're in e-books as well, but there's a sense of, well, we have to be selective in what we're going to publish. So does your topic interest our readers? Is there a market for it? And that in itself then has its own sort of minefield of problems for you to sort of navigate your way around if you do want to get published.
Yeah. So I suppose it can lead to some people maybe changing their ideas to be more marketable, can't it?
Mm.
And maybe not being quite so forthright in their views, or maybe changing their focus slightly to be more marketable. And I suppose that's to the dearth of academic inquiry, really, isn't it?
Yeah, in a way, you're undermining your academic output. For the market, because I mean, the market's not necessarily always right. I mean, that sort of goes without saying, but. Yeah, so that, I mean, that in itself is then problematic. And also, there are probably lots of people out there who've got really good stuff ready to go that just basically haven't been picked up. Or they end up with a small publisher and their book never really gets seen and actually their output's really good. But then you want to get published, so are you better off going with a small publisher or not getting published at all? Which brings us to this whole sort of self-publishing concept.
Yeah, so I think we should probably explain about what self-publishing is, shouldn't we?
Yeah, and it can take many forms. So we should probably cover the internet and then you've got the sort of the print versions as well. So ultimately, self-publishing, I guess you could say, is any form of disseminating your research off your own back, I guess. So that could include, I suppose, putting your academic articles in blogs or on a website, for example. And then there's also that you can actually set it up to be print and actually have physical copies of your book or your articles as well. Obviously, that comes with its own sort of pros and cons. Pros, it gets in print. You have your complete control over what's being published. Can technically be cheaper. If you're publishing articles online, it can be cheaper. But then there are also loads of cons as well, including, I mean, we could say cost again if it is the book route you're taking, because you'll end up spending money on it. You won't make money back on it. The issue of actually being found and discoverability, because often if you're just putting it on a website, then like, is it going to be found? It might not be found, probably won't be found. And then obviously, of course, this whole idea of, well, it needs to have some sort of academic credibility. And how do we grant academic credibility to something? Well, there's this whole sort of system of sort of steps that you sort of have to go through. Whether or not those steps are right or not is another question, but there is still a sort of element of you do at least benefit from the halo effect of whatever journal you're in or whatever publishing house you're with when you do publish something, which gives credence to the things that you've produced.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to me, that's kind of the main, the halo effect is to me the biggest question, I think. Because it's not, maybe it's not just that if you self-publish, you don't have the backing of a journal or a publisher, but it's also not, part of that backing is that review process, isn't it? And so even though, I think, when you submit a draft article or a draft piece of work, to you, almost always that's going to be as close to perfect as you could make it in the time frame. And, you know, it's as good enough as you could make it.
Yeah.
So to you, it's really good. I mean, you wouldn't really submit a piece if you thought it was rubbish.
No.
Or maybe some people would, because they kind of want the reviewers to kind of help them develop their ideas. But yeah. I mean, that's abusing the process, isn't it? So it's kind of, if you self-publish, you're almost publishing what would be kind of the submitted piece. It's not had those additional kind of improvements or comments from, other kind of experts in the field. I suppose you could send it to an expert in the field to and then see what they think about it. And people do that often. You get articles and books and stuff, and in the thank yous, it's people who read it and commented on it and offered improvements. But it's a very different interaction and relationship in terms of asking somebody you know and probably a friend or an acquaintance or colleague to ask something. Somebody who you're going to interact with and they know who you are and everything that. You couldn't really imagine somebody, if you're friendly enough with someone to ask them to review or to comment on a piece of work for you, it's unlikely they're going to be like, no, this is completely wrong, this is terrible.
I suppose if you were doing that, you'd have to have a sort of certain relationship with them to be able to trust them and to be able to accept their comments and criticism and so forth.
Yeah.
But then why would you do it if you're not going to get anything out of it, if the book's not going to get read? But then are they read anyway? Because they're very expensive and...
Yeah, I suppose that's a subsequent point, isn't it?
They're quite niche.
Oh, well, yeah. So self-publishing books, because it's... You don't sort of have that backing of the publisher or the journal in terms of advertising either. I suppose that kind of books, a lot of it, what we might call advertising, is really kind of the email list, isn't it? If this is what's new from Oxford University Press or Routledge or whoever. And you can dismiss it as, oh, it's just an email list or it's just a flyer at a conference on a conference table, but that's actually where all of kind of academic books are kind of advertised. That's just the way it's done.
Yeah.
Even if compared with, you know, a bestseller from Penguin Books, you know, would be advertised on the side of buses, on the side of bus stops, and, you know, posted all over big cities and whatever.
Mm.
So, obviously you're never going to get that with an academic book, but you kind of need some sort of method of exposing your work, don't you?
Which is where the cost and the time sort of comes into it. I mean, I should probably point out here that I have experience directly of self-publishing, not in an academic sense, but for a young adult fiction book I wrote. And this is very much a case in point where it could be the best book in the world, but ultimately, if you can't build up a readership, then it's not going to find an audience, even if it is amazing, which is a problem, especially if you're just doing it on your own and off your own back. So you can do marketing to a certain extent, but then it's like, well, how much of my own money do I want to throw into this? Like, I mean, I've thrown a reasonable amount of money into sort of the marketing side of things, but then ultimately it's just my money. Like, I'm not backed by a massive publishing house, so the exposure that I get is all sort of self-generated, and I'm relying on other people a lot. But at the same time, I've also dedicated my own time to it, and it's like, well, I'm trying to be an academic at the same time, so how much time do I have? If my job is to be an academic or to be a writer, like, I can't spend all my time doing the marketing for the thing that I've written, because I need to pass it on to someone else.
Yeah. I suppose in that way, it's kind of, you need that someone to spend their professional time and skills helping you, don't you?
Yeah, and to invest the money, essentially,
yeah.
Because it's the publishing. I mean, it's the very fact that Penguin or whatever have got their massive list of companies that they send review copies out to and all this, and they've got their sort of contacts, and just the very fact that Penguin will send it out to the bookshops, will get it on the shelves, to then be exposed to people, and then people can make their own minds up over whether it's any good or not.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, you can't, even if you've written the best book in the world and you've self-published it, you can't. No one's going to know it's the best book in the world if you can't get them to know about it.
Get it into people's hands.
To actually read about it, yeah.
Yeah, well, very much so, because, I mean, one example is, like, I've signed my book up to, like, the Kindle sort of unlimited access thing, where essentially what it means is, if you've got Amazon Prime, you can get it on your Kindle for free and read it for free. Like, it just comes as part of your access to Amazon's sort of digital books sort of library, which you get with Prime membership. In exchange for that, basically you say, well, it's digitally exclusive to Amazon digitally, which is fine for me as far as I'm concerned. But at the same time, well, yeah, it's free and anyone can access it, but they need to know that they're going to access it. And then what happens is you then get recompensed based on the sort of percentage of pages that get read that Amazon's able to track through Kindles and whatever. So, and I'm less concerned with the money, more just about getting some readership. But at the same time, people still need to know that it's there to then want to do it. And you're competing against thousands and thousands and thousands of other books.
Yeah, I suppose the thing about self-publishing it is that it's allowed everybody who's had an idea of a novel to go out there and publish it, isn't it? Or maybe not just novel, other ideas too. Because I remember going to, a few times I've sort of been walking round small towns, you know, because I've been to visit or passing through or whatever, and you know, you see a poster for a novel about set in that town.
Yeah, there's a lot of that stuff.
Quite a few of them, and I feel like that's quite. It's quite a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
Especially if you've kind of lived somewhere for a while and you've kind of, you know, lots of stories about it and how, and you could maybe weave them together into an interesting narrative. I think that's quite a cool thing to do. But as we were saying, if it happens in every town, you know, there's probably one or two people in every town who are interested in doing it and have always dreamed of becoming a novelist, and it kind of allows them to live their dream in a way.
I mean, that's what would be described in the trade as vanity publishing. So, I mean, you could describe what I've done as vanity publishing. Yes and no. I mean, I can argue a point later, but in a sense of, you're not concerned about making any money from it. The idea is, actually, you've got this idea that you want to put out there. You're willing to invest some time and money in it. And thanks to sort of technology, where we are these days and how processes transformed, it's reasonably cheap to do that. As you say, there's also a difference, I think, between the online only versions and then getting it set up for print, which is a sort of separate task in itself, and I think is also another avenue that can differentiate books. Because you're right, because putting something on Kindle is even easier. I mean, anyone can write a PDF or put a Amazon sort of Kindle file together.
Yeah.
Which is where you see all these weird, saucy books on Amazon when you start sort of searching the sort of nether regions of sort of the places that. Sorry, that wasn't a good sort of pun link there, but regions. So yeah, but when you start search, sometimes when you search on sort of page 2 and 3 and 4, when you're searching any particular book, you'll find like loads of really sort of raunchy looking book covers that have clearly been designed very cheaply by any number of people that's only available on Kindle, and you're like, okay, right, I see. So there's a lot of fan fiction out there as well. Yeah. So those sorts of things.
So that's the thing. Yeah, I think most people don't realise how big a thing fan fiction is, do they?
No, fan fiction is a very big thing. And our friend Danielle Gerard, who has not yet appeared on the podcast, is the person to get on to talk about that. If you're listening, Danielle, please come on soon. But yeah, no, fan fiction is a big thing. But then how much is there a market for it? And why do people do it? And that's part of the issue as well, I think.
Yeah, I suppose with self-publishing, even if there isn't a market for it, you can still put it out there.
Yeah.
If it doesn't sell, it doesn't matter. You've still done it. And yeah, I suppose if you're a vanity, if you're in it for the vanity publishing, then yeah, it doesn't necessarily matter if anyone even reads it.
No, but then there is, you'd like to think that you might make some money back from it.
Well, I suppose that's the thing. Everyone thinks that, oh, I'll self-publish and somebody will read it and that person will, and then someone will hear about it and they'll have a massive, I don't know, social media following, and it'll suddenly become this big cult thing.
Mm.
That's what everyone wants to do. I absolutely don't blame anyone, because that's the dream, isn't it?
Mm.
But the likelihood of it happening, probably quite low.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're sort of millions to one, really.
The likelihood of it happening in academia?
Well, yeah, even still in academia. Again, because as academics, we have to trust, because we can't sift through the entirety of the catalogue of the works of humankind. Like, as academics, we need to know that when we're looking up works on Shakespeare, I don't know, you know what I mean? When you're looking up your area, that those books that have been published have at least got some sort of academic credentials behind them. Even if we don't agree with their points, often we don't. But that at least, that's a certain sifting process that's been taken, that's been done, that's been carried out on our behalf. Though, of course, that comes with its own problems, in that often it means that things that could potentially be good or are actually sifted out because of the market issue, and then you've got the markets feeding into it again, and then you've got this whole sort of cycle. I was just mentioning to you before we started recording, I do actually own an academic self-published book. It's not academic per se, but it's called Swarm Troopers. Mm. It's about drones, it's about swarm technology and stuff. It's basically put together by a journalist. So the writer himself does have some sort of professional credential in that sense, and this stuff has been published on the internet in various places, and he does do a properly cited work. So to me, I thought that was quite interesting that they've got what is actually quite niche, because there aren't really any books about swarm drones so much, but he's got a whole book put together sort of by himself and maybe with sort of some editors, and actually the stuff in there is quite interesting, and it is properly referenced so that I can actually follow up the things that he's claimed. So actually there is that element, so I am still capable of checking out what he's done.
I think I own 2 self-published books actually. One of them was, I'm pretty sure, it's just somebody who did a master's, and their master's thesis was about autonomous weapons, and then they just decided to self-publish it. And I bought it on Amazon for like £4.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt a little bit like, well, good on you for making a couple of quid out of it.
Yeah.
But also, like, lots of people who want to kind of have their work read will just put it on like one of the kind of online repositories websites like academia.edu or ResearchGate or SSRN, where basically you can host work that you've written. Lots of full-time academics will host like draft versions of their articles or pre-publication versions, so that if you don't have subscriptions to particular journals, you can still read it.
Mm.
So I was kind of a bit like, well, if you just wanted people to read your master's thesis, why didn't you just do that? But also, it was kind of, I think what disappointed me most about it was that it was basically, they basically hadn't re-edited it.
Right.
Or it didn't feel like they'd re-edited it.
So it's just basically copy-paste into a book format.
Basically just taking their master's thesis, I presume, was marked all right.
Yeah.
And you got a decent mark for it, grade for it or whatever. And then it was just, took the Word file, put a new front page on it, and sent it to Ashton to be a book.
And the thing is, a master's thesis particularly, it's got less academic rigour than a PhD thesis, yeah. Because it doesn't go through the viva process and the sort of 3 years of work. So actually, I think that you can actually have some glaring errors. There could be potentially glaring errors in a master's thesis.
Potentially, yeah. So that was kind of, I was a bit disappointed when I got that. And then the other self-published book that I've got, or academic one, was a guy, so he's basically like, fascinated by systems theory, and he's kind of an expert in systems theory. And because it's systems theory and complexity theory and all those kind of linked kind of areas, are quite difficult to get into if you don't, if you're not being taught it face to face and someone's not explaining it to you, it's quite difficult to understand from just reading books about it. So he basically decided that he was going to write a book that was, you could start from nothing and understand systems theory and complexity theory.
Right.
At the end of it, or at least have enough knowledge to then be able to jump into it.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. I thought it was quite good because it was quite short. It was just a little e-book, and also because if you're not restricted to writing it in a particularly academic sort of way,
yeah,
you can actually write it in a very simple way.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of unrestricted ability in self-publishing is really good for in some circumstances.
Having complete control over how your output and how it's presented.
Yeah, because you can basically take something very complex and explain it as you would to a 5-year-old.
Mm.
Whereas the flip side of that, of course, is someone can be writing in a very complex, convoluted, difficult to understand way, and it's still on the page and it's still going to be published in that manner.
Yes.
Obviously, it's unintended consequences of control, isn't it?
Yeah, and this links back to this area of research. I've sort of had this idea in the back of my head. Sort of, before I started my PhD, actually, I was looking at like the internet and sort of internet culture and news culture. And this ties in with the self-publishing thing in the sense of it's this sort of, you're kind of opening up, you're opening up the market to potentially anyone. And there was this big debate, especially in the internet, in the early 2000s, between this idea of, well, you've got the cult of the amateur.
Mm.
So what is the internet? I think it's Andrew Keen, I think it is Andrew Keen. Yeah, Andrew Keen. The cult of the amateur. And this idea that, well, basically the internet has meant that anyone can put anything out there. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, you could be like a world-leading expert, professor, or you could be just a kid in their bedroom. And both of those sort of outputs are almost considered equivalent. And this is what we see with the fake news thing, because essentially, and Web 2 and Web 3. But then you've got this other side to the argument where they say, well, actually, the internet is a really sort of liberating force, and it sort of promotes lots of sort of interactions, and people can work together and collaborate in new and innovative ways. And there's this sort of tension, I guess, between the liberating potential and the great power that self-publishing offers, I guess. So I can put out whatever I want out there on my website, or then I could pay if I wanted to put some money and print it or whatever. But then at the same time, you've got this fact that, well, I could be anyone. I mean, I'm not, obviously, because I do have some sort of expertise in what I talk about, but who's to know? There's no way of verifying that. And ultimately, I'm then fighting against the millions and millions of other sort of monkeys tapping on their keyboards, like that sort of famous metaphor, ideas, concept of the monkeys on the keyboards. But I'm fighting against all those other voices who are probably shouting even louder than me. So actually, how is anyone to even find what I put out there when you're competing against sort of pictures of cats and like the latest sort of remix of someone's pop video?
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is that if you're an academic, you've done a PhD, kind of being able to put doctor in front or PhD at the back of the suffix of your name gives you more cachet, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I think you've probably preceded the
point. But, okay, carry on.
Is that just by putting PhD at the end of your name,
yeah,
it means that you've got a doctorate, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're an expert in the area you're writing on.
Well, there is that. No, and you didn't guess what I was guessing. I was just going to make a brief mention of Gillian McKeith.
Oh, yes,
which is, which is what I thought you were when you were looking at me. I thought, but it does, yeah, so you're right. It doesn't mean that you're an expert in that area. You're right. And we discussed this in the ghostwriting episode, where I told you about someone that I worked with who had a PhD, who used their PhD illegitimately to basically pretend that they were an expert in dental anaesthetics when their PhD was in classic sexuality.
Yeah, because what you're supposed to do is, if you're writing in your area, you can put doctor as your name, isn't
yeah.
it? Because if you're writing somewhere beyond your area, you're supposed to write your name and then PhD. But of course, most people don't realise there's a difference.
No, there is that, yeah. And ultimately, anyone could put doctor before their name. There's no power, there's no authority out there that's shutting down websites and publications that anyone has missed. Quoted their qualifications.
Well, yeah,
you just go on LinkedIn, for example.
Because obviously, I remember an example that sticks in my mind is found someone on LinkedIn who was given an honorary doctorate and used the doctor.
Yeah,
in their professional life.
Right. Yeah. So they're sort of cheating the system a bit there.
But one of the things that I think about, because you mentioned fake news before, it's probably not unusual to find websites or articles on shady sort of websites that say, Dr. Such a Body, Oxford University, Cambridge University, wherever, says this. Well, most people aren't going to go and search for their name on the Oxford University or Cambridge or whatever university website.
Yeah.
And so actually, some people do just make up these people.
Yeah.
They don't exist.
Well, you could even imply a certain relationship without it actually being explicit. So I could say Mike Ryder, Lancaster.
Yeah.
And the assumption there is I'm of the university, and the assumption is therefore I'm some sort of researcher. I could be a janitor, not to dismiss janitors, but if I'm talking about an expertise field, do you know what I mean? So the same with the Oxford thing, especially, because it could be Oxford Brookes, if you said just Josh Hughes, Oxford. But equally, it could just be lives in Oxford.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I think that's just the thing I've noticed as well, is that a couple of, what is it? The thing of the Oxford Research Group.
Yeah.
Which is it's a private entity that does research about kind of war and conflict and stuff and linked kind of ideas. But they don't make it clear. But from the outside, you think Oxford Research Group must be linked to the University of Oxford.
Yeah.
It's not.
It's just a group.
It's just a group. And I mean, I know their work is all right. Mm. But kind of Oxford Research Group, you can't kind of argue with them in the fact that it's based in Oxford.
Yeah, that's
it's perfectly legitimate to name a research group after where you are.
Yeah.
Like if we had the Lancaster Research Group,
yeah,
it wouldn't necessarily, you can't really say.
It's not.
You shouldn't have done that.
No.
But actually, kind of, from the outside, it's not. If you kind of just assume, if you're a bit naive and you don't really realise that people can do this, you see Oxford Research Group, you just assume it's linked to the University of Oxford.
Yeah, because there's a lot of cultural cachet associated with the term Oxford,
for
example. And I wonder as well if maybe there's this concept of, can it be used as a protected term? Wasn't there something recently about, was it Liverpool? Or was it someone was trying to trademark, like, the Liverpool words, like, to be able to use it only in certain ways? I'm being a bit vague. I don't mean to be vague, but there is a sense that you're right. Like, I wonder to what extent you can legitimately use Oxford in that way, because there is an issue of the brand as well, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so another thing that I'd noticed was there's an NGO. I won't name them, but kind of if you look at their address, it gives that they've sort of named their house. So it's basically a guy in his bedroom or in a home office, and they've named they've given their house a fancy name.
Mm.
It sounds like it's vaguely if you could imagine it being linked to Oxford University,
right?
And then just says Oxford underneath it, and then the road and the postcode. So you could, if you're a bit naive, you could perhaps assume it was linked to an Oxford college, or it was a part of Oxford University, but actually it's just something
in his house. I mean, you could very easily, I mean, I've done this before, you can buy PO Box addresses.
Yeah.
It's a subscription, it costs a couple of hundred quid.
Yeah.
So Josh Hughes, PO Box 100, Oxford. Basically, it's easy done.
Yeah.
But again, this is just the whole problem of authenticity and so on, which links this whole self-publishing thing, which then links again to this wider sense of, well, the internet has it's a great liberating tool and a great liberating power that anyone can do this, but at the same time, it makes it very hard to be able to distinguish the truth or sort of expertise from non-experts. The two blur together and you have this problem, basically, that means that, yes, it can potentially be really positive, but at the same time, any old person could do any old thing, and it becomes... And this is why we have this problem with fake news, and this is why we have this problem with lack of trust in people and organisations and so forth, because anyone could do anything, which is quite depressing, but... There we go.
I suppose it's kind of the great democratisation of the internet was kind of always the dream, wasn't it? And people haven't really connected on a level of, let's talk about this amazing idea.
No.
It's become people who are interested in that idea, they're going to talk about it, even if they aren't, even if they don't have any expertise or real grounding in it.
Yeah.
Most people are just going to talk about the mundane lives and pictures of cats.
Yeah, and it's the anonymity part of it, I guess, because there's no way of verifying who they are. And anyone can set up any range of number of identities, which again links to the whole authenticity. So you can't therefore differentiate between me making a point and some kid in their bedroom making a point if they're both called Mike. And that's just the whole problem we've got to face.
What it's just made me think of is the film Catch Me If You Can.
Okay.
Because in that film, it's about a con man who pretends to be other people and manages to get make lots of money through it, basically.
Yeah.
One of the things he does is he pretends to be a lawyer. And in order to pass the bar exam, he just studies really hard for it.
Mm.
But say you weren't pretending to be a lawyer. Say you were pretending to be another type of expert.
Mm.
And you could, in lots of areas, you can probably get away with actually having quite little expertise. Just a general grounding of general principles that you can think about and you can apply and maybe have a few interesting ideas about. And I wonder if you could probably get away with actually just pretending to be an expert with actually very little amount of expertise.
Well, I think you probably could. I mean, if you see these experts put on the telly or on the news, obviously the news, because the media is always in, they're always demanding sort of experts, inverted commas, so they'll get someone from that a university maybe or not. But it doesn't mean that the journalist researcher necessarily knows about their specific thing that their research is in.
Mm.
They just know that you might have a sort of knowledge in this area. So I think yeah, you very easily could. I mean, Gillian McKeith is the great example. We can use her as a good example now. But yeah, you're right.
If you aren't familiar with the Gillian McKeith story, you should listen to our
Bad Science episode.
Bad Science episode. So,
yeah.
When she was Ben Goldacre, the author of Bad Science, goes into great detail about how she essentially, well, did fake having a PhD.
Yeah, I mean, she's technically got it from this sort of college place, but whether you'd actually say it's a proper...
Well, it isn't. It's not an accredited body. And
no.
The quality of her academic work was left much to be desired.
But the point is, though, you or I, we could do it ourselves. In fact, we could do it. We could, like tomorrow, we'll sit down, write our own nutrition book by Doctors Mike and Josh, and set ourselves up as poo experts. As Gillian McKeith does, and maybe we can make a lot of money out of it.
Perhaps.
But again, that's the whole problem with all of this whole publishing malarkey, which is difficult. But I don't think there's any easy answer really at this point.
No, and I think, as I've sort of alluded to, there can be some benefits for academic self-publishing, but they're kind of quite small, and in the face of not having any, in the face of, if you want to publish a big book or you want to turn your thesis into a monograph, not having kind of the cachet of a proper academic publisher can probably be harmful, I think, probably. Yeah.
Or at least not beneficial.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, well, how do you get your stuff out there? But then it's the market, isn't it? You're fighting against the market and you've got to balance like the originality of your work versus doing something that's going to make money for the publishers, which is depressing. But is the sort of reality of the situation, unfortunately, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, on that delightful, positive note, I think that brings us to an end of another episode. Well,
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.